Welcome again to this Mockingbird Conference, the seventh year. It is such a delight and a privilege and a joy to speak to you and to see you and to hopefully get to know many of you and to ask you the question of the conference, which is the one that was on the postcard and the one that's on the front of that bulletin, which is a scary, scary question. And it's a question, who knows who posed that question most famously? We can interact for a second. Can you see the real me? What you may not know is that this conference is actually not an opportunity to speak to you about identity. It's an opportunity for me to speak about the who. Because the who are, or Pete Townsend in particular, they are the ones who wrote the song The Real Me, which opens Quadrophenia, their great, great album. And as you know, of course, by the name of the band, the who, themes of identity, questions, who am I? Can you see the real me? This lies at the heart, not just of their name, but their entire modus operandi. And can you see the real me? That song, you have a young man named Jimmy that is sort of the central character of Quadrophenia. And Quadrophenia refers to the fact that he's got four distinct personalities as represented by the who. It actually works, especially if you listen to it. The synthesizers are incredible. And he's kind of having a nervous breakdown because he doesn't know who he is. And in that song, he talks about going to ask his mother, Mom, can you see the real me? He asks a doctor, a psychiatrist, can you see the real me? I want someone to give me an answer. And then finally, and this is why Townsend is of such interest, he asks a preacher, can you see the real me, preacher? So that's what the title of this talk is about. And I'm going to try to use the who to maybe begin to answer this question. This question, which, you know, everyone, you know, you walk into a room, you say, what are you talking about? You know, oh, we're talking about you. And then you think, oh, that's my favorite subject. And so hopefully it's if it's not your favorite subject, maybe it's your least favorite subject, but it's certainly one we think about constantly and a lot. And it's why not have a conference about it? Identity, if we were to use a shorthand for it, you know, we don't really need one, but it's simply how you define yourself. We had this friend who made up these business cards when he was in college, and it just said his name, and then underneath his title, it said, Environmentalist Christian Funk Bassist. And those were his identity markers. You know, you want to invite that guy to the party, I think. But what are your identity markers? Identity markers could have to do with your presentation, with your pedigree, with your profession, with any number of things, with who your parents were, who your children are, who they're not, anything. It can have to do with your achievements, just as much as your identity can have to do with the tragedies you've suffered. Have to do with the things that you can control, the choices you make, maybe your spouse, your clothing, and the things you can't control, like your family. You're supposed to laugh. But identity is simply the answer to the question, however you answer the question, who am I? But in practice, this is a question, this all-important question, which has consumed human beings since day one, is a question that we feel that we can get right or wrong. Isn't it? There's so many value judgments in the question, who am I? We may deny it, but it's true. And so if it's a question we feel we can get right or wrong, that means we're in the realm of righteousness. This religious word that seems so antiquated, yet is so omnipresent when you're dealing with identity. Where are you on the scale of who you feel you should be versus who you actually are? This means that on a deeper level, if it's actually a question of righteousness, if identity is a question of righteousness, on a deeper level, the real question behind who am I is the question not just who am I, but am I enough? Am I enough? And for some of us, every single interaction, every single day, every single blog post is an opportunity to try to answer that question. And you know someone who you find it difficult or draining to be around because you feel like they're constantly asking you, who am I to you? Who am I to you? And you can tell them, but they never seem to listen. And eventually you just give up. There's nothing wrong with the answers we give to the question, who am I? There's nothing wrong with being a funk bassist. In fact, there's everything right with being a funk bassist. It's not that there's anything wrong per se with our identity markers. It's just that they can't bear the weight of our justification. And there we are again, in another theological word. Yet justification is something we talk a lot about it on Mockingbird, but people's need to justify their existence, their profession, their choices, this occupies an enormous amount of our energy. And oftentimes we don't want it to, but it does. And therefore, to talk about identity in relation to anxiety is a very natural thing. Because if this is a question that is freighted with righteousness, with something I could get it wrong, or, you know, I really wish I wasn't who I think I am, well, then you're going to be very fearful about how that question is answered. A lot is riding on it. And we hear a lot about in our culture right now about how rates of anxiety are just skyrocketing around the country, especially among sort of a younger generation. My favorite statistic, which we quote all the time, is this one psychiatrist who said that the average rate of anxiety in a high school graduate today is the same as it was in the average psychiatric patient in the 1950s. That's the degree of anxiety we're dealing with in a culture. But what on earth does anxiety even mean? Because, you know, it can mean something, it's a bit of a catch-all, right? Yes, it means fear, a sort of amorphous fear that doesn't, it's about uncertainty, and it's not about you're afraid of a bear coming at you. You're anxious about the fact that there might be bears out there, right? But, you know, anxiety to a doctor is different than an anxiety, to a philosopher, which is different, is anxiety a psychological problem? Like Freud would say, the product of sort of your childhood trauma, your sexual inhibitions. Is it a philosophical problem, as Plato and Spinoza and today's cognitive behavioral therapists would have it? Is it a spiritual condition, as Kierkegaard so clearly said? Or is it, as so many cultural commentators from Auden and Camus to Tim Kreider, who we'll hear from tomorrow, is it a cultural condition, a function of the times we live in and the structure of our society? These are the questions about anxiety. Well, tonight, I'm not going to answer them, but I am going to suggest three different ways that we think about anxiety as it's related to our identity. The first way is the most prevalent way, the easiest one to write about, frankly, and that is what John was speaking about just recently. It's called presentation anxiety. And presentation anxiety, how you are perceived by other people, your anxieties about that, that is probably in an age of social media and technology where we're constantly presenting ourselves 24/7 to the world. And if you're not doing it, then, you know, your children are, or you're doing it in maybe a way that you're not aware of. But this sort of what you leave in and what you leave out of how other people perceive you, that is a presentation anxiety. And it has the word that is used, that we used, someone used on our website this past week, is curation. You might as well call it curation anxiety. We curate our identities. What we allow people to see, we select what we want them to see and what we don't want them to see. curation. This is the modern buzzword. And along these lines, I was struck by a story about W.H. Auden, this wonderful poet that we came across recently. Someone wrote a letter to the Times of London last year and recalled the following incident. She said, 60 years ago, my English teacher brought me to London from my provincial grammar school for a literary conference. Understandably, she abandoned me for her friends when we arrived, and I was left to flounder. I was gauche and inept and had no idea what to do with myself. Auden must have sensed this because he approached me and said, everyone here is just as nervous as you are, but they are bluffing, and you must learn to bluff too. When we were sending out that magazine last month, I thought, this is the best bluff we've ever pulled off. Meaning, like, you know, it looks so professional. If you only knew who was behind it. But bluffing, this need to curate, it creates a huge amount of anxiety. As Scott Stossel, the editor of The Atlantic, wrote recently, he says, to some people I may seem calm, but if you could peer underneath the surface, you would see that I'm like a duck, paddling, paddling, paddling. Bluffing is not just what we do at cocktail parties and literary functions and Christmas parties and, you know, it happens at church. Kay Warren, the wife of Bill Warren, Rick Warren, the megachurch pastor, gave an interview this past week about her son who committed suicide, and it was a very public crisis that happened to them last year. And this was on the anniversary of her son's horrible death. And she was asked sort of to talk about what went on. And this is what she said. She said, growing up in an evangelical church with my dad as a pastor, he didn't express his negative emotions. He was all just happy, happy, joy, joy. You just didn't talk about it. My brother was a heroin addict, and they didn't tell anybody in their church what they were going through. I didn't know anybody growing up that talked about their feelings. Now, that kind of bluffing is not innocuous. That's the kind of bluffing that leaves a person isolated and alone and dangerous to themselves. But not all bluffing, not all curation is so negative. But when it becomes a compulsion to assert your own happiness without ever taking a break, well, then you're on a short road to unhappiness. Because being happy all the time, pretending to be happy, actually attempting to be happy, that is exhausting. That is exhausting. And just talk to Kay Warren if you don't believe me. Because you're in this impossible bind where you want to both stand out and be accepted. You must be enough according to the arbitrary standards, the little L law that we like to say, of the day. You have to be righteous according to the likes or whatever you want on your profile. That is where your justification is coming from. And the fruit may be exhaustion in your life. It may be disillusionment. It may be cynicism. It may be leaving church altogether. It may be leaving social media altogether. You can't actually outrun this, unfortunately. But this is what Salinger was talking about when he wrote that passage in Franny and Zoe that we used in our publicity. When he said, this is Franny who's having a nervous breakdown. This young woman, this New Yorker, very sophisticated girl, she meets with her brother and says, just because I like applause and people to rave about me doesn't make it right. I'm ashamed of it. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of not having the courage to be an absolute nobody. I'm sick of myself and everyone else that wants to make some kind of splash. Now, people can make splashes in great ways. We can do wonderful things. But you probably know what she's talking about. The competition. The feeling that you must stand out in order to be accepted. It's daunting. It's scary. It's what we call the law. Whit Stillman put it a different way in his movies Damsels in Distress. The character Violet says, there's all this, excuse me, actually it's Lily. So there's all this propaganda in favor of uniqueness, eccentricity, independence, etc. But does the world really want or need more of such traits? Aren't such people usually terrible pains in the neck? What the world needs to work properly is a large mass of normal people. I'd like to be one of those. Ironically enough, saying that distinguishes her so much that she's not so clearly not a normal person. But that's Stillman. But this fear that drives so much of our life, and it certainly drives so much. Mockingbird has, a lot of it takes place online, and so when you spend a lot of time online, you realize that this sort of drives a lot of the internet. And human beings are more than just their online personas. We all know that. And the internet isn't bad or good per se. But we do know that what Brené Brown calls the shame-based fear of being ordinary is a serious factor in what it means to live in the modern world. The shame-based fear of being ordinary. What would it mean if you were just a normal person? Not that there's anyone's normal, but you know what I mean. So the need to curate produces kind of loneliness and despair. Writing for the American Reader, this woman, Rosa Smith, wrote about this story that Dostoevsky wrote called The Double. I haven't read the story, but I've read an article about it. I thought I was going to bluff, actually, and act like I'd read the story, but I haven't read the story. But she talks about this dynamic, because the story is about a man who splits into a double, and the double takes on all of his ideal traits, his doppelganger, but in the positive sense. And he becomes competitive with this double, and it sounds like an incredible story. We should all go read it. But she writes, she says, you are uncomfortably conscious of the fact that your created, curated self is not really you, that you've played up a few things, kept a few other things hidden, put on a mask for your digital friend. And what would they think of you if they found out about, well, you? Thus, the anxieties of digital life return when the double, your online persona, through its interactions with the friends you hope to gain, is conceived as yet another separate, hostile social being. Paranoid narcissism haunts our online interactions and feeds our social anxieties. Now that's a dark take. But Pete Townsend would agree. Maybe you've read his, you've listened to his song. You probably haven't, because it's a sort of a rare song, I guess. But he wrote a song called However Much I Booze. And that's a great title for a song, right? However Much I Booze. The opening lines are, I see myself on TV. I'm a faker, a paper clown. It's clear to all my friends that I habitually lie. I just bring them down. I claim proneness to exaggeration, but the truth lies in my frustration that however much I booze, there's ain't no way out. Sounding like Sartre there at the end. But this is a man who decided to stop bluffing, and it led to despair. But keep that in the back of your mind as we continue, because the second anxiety is the anxiety about not really knowing who you are. It has less to do with other people, but who actually are you? Are you just this one thing and not these others? You know, we try to find a fixed identity for ourselves. And whatever answer we come up with, whether it has to do with our social status, or the car we drive, or our physical appearance, or our children, or our religious identification, these things are moving targets. Maybe it's enough for a while, but then it changes. The law of identity, of who you should be, has no satisfaction. This is why we laugh when The Onion reports that fully realized Kanye West moves to Quiet Farm in Iowa. The absurdity of Kanye saying, you know, on Friday night, when I read that my album got a 10.0 on Pitchfork, that's when I got it. I finally got all the affirmation I needed. I booked my tickets to Iowa. And of course, even when we do find an answer, because people do find answers, there are answers to the question, who am I? But they're provisional. and they're incomplete. You know, Walt Whitman says that we contain multitudes, and he's not wrong. The philosopher psychologist Adam Phillips says it this way. He says, when people say, I'm the kind of person who, my heart always sinks. We've all got about 10 formulas about who we are, what we like, the kind of people we like, all that stuff. But the disparity between these phrases and how one experiences oneself minute by minute is ludicrous. It's like the caption under a painting. You think, well, yeah, I can see that it's called that. But you need to look at the picture. In his biography, Who I Am, Pete Townsend looks back on the period following his greatest success, the success of Tommy in 1969. And he writes about what he was like afterwards. He said, from this point forward, my life was often fraught with the paradox of success. When I was brainstorming every day, searching deeply into myself for some kind of kickstart for inspiration, my actions sometimes seemed deranged and absurd. This wasn't clinical schizophrenia, though in some ways it produced big mood swings and compulsive behavior in me. I was still a young man, and I didn't really understand the pressures on me or the damage I might cause to those around me. My spiritual longings, Townsend is a very religious guy, were constantly under siege by all too worldly ambitions, undermined by residual skepticism and ambivalence. Even the addictions that would plague me for years seemed to have no internal consistency, regularity, or logic. I could be sober and responsible for days, weeks, months, even years. I could behave with dignity and take a range of ambitious commitments that would lead me into new, exalted circles, not only musically but intellectually. I could strive to achieve and even pioneer radical acts on behalf of social change. And I could also behave, frankly, like a complete beep. I was a workaholic, running away from the present and probably the past, because something about my life made me uneasy. I was myself a really desperate man. At a time when I could have been supremely happy, I was feeling ashamed about being an adulterer and oddly guilty about my professional success. What Townsend is articulating is that who I am, who you are, is almost never one thing and not another. Or if it is now, it won't be later. This is why the adage that we hear given to college graduates, to be yourself, can be crippling. It can be actually just as crippling as the adage, be that person. Because very few people at the age of 22 can take an inward journey and come out having discovered a developed self. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. That's from Won't Get Fooled Again. But the final anxiety, and I swear this won't go on forever, is the anxiety that we don't talk enough about. And it's not the anxiety of how others perceive you, or it's not the anxiety that you might not really have a self that has any kind of consistency. It's the anxiety that you sort of develop, I think, a little later in life, generally. It's that once you figure out who you actually are, you don't like that person. Or there's something not quite right about that person. And it's usually in ways that are out of your control. Maybe something's been done to you that has left not just a bruise, but a scar. Maybe there's something you cannot change. This is why the New Yorker cartoon is such a classic, where the man is looking at the wife and he says, I wish my identity weren't so tied up with who I am. Some of us, the realization of who we are brings with it a not enoughness that we come by honestly. And it goes deeper than who you are. It has to do with who you are not, or who you feel you could have been. Adam Phillips again writes in a post, by the way, that got the most clicks of any post we've posted in the past year. And so I got the internet behind me on this one, people, you know. I was so surprised, and Ethan was too, who posted it. You know, you spend like, you know, 3 days on something about, you know, the who, and then you write like, you excerpt a paragraph from someone much smarter than you, like Adam Phillips, and it just goes viral. And you think, why am I even doing this? But Adam Phillips writes, our lived lives might become a protracted mourning for or an endless tantrum about the lives we were unable to live. But the exemptions we suffer, whether forced or chosen, make us who we are. As we know more now than ever before about the kinds of lives it is possible to live, we are always haunted by the myth of our potential, of what we might have it in ourselves to be or do. So some of us, are grieving or regretting or resenting our failure to be ourselves as we imagine we could be. We share our lives with the people we have failed to be. The myth of our potential can make our lives into a perpetual falling short, a continual and continuing loss, a sustained and sometimes sustaining rage. Now, he's just describing what bitterness is. But he's what's describing what Judith Shulevitz, writing for the New Republic, calls the myth of the counterfactual. It's what Tim Kreider calls the referendum. That the reason people fall out of touch in midlife with their closest friends is because you started at the same point, and by the time you're 35, their direction in life represents a total judgment on yours. I'm sorry. You look around and see others who have taken different paths, and they represent a potential self. Someone who decided not to have kids. Someone who never got married. Someone who went to business school and didn't start a nonprofit at the bottom of the recession. Regret becomes a dominating sentiment in this form of existence. And when we run into people like this, we are inspired to justify ourselves. We have to justify our directions and our decisions with renewed vigor to validate ourselves even at the expense of others. Remember what Ray Davies, the singer for the Kinks, said in 1967? He was 27 at the time. He said, "If I could live again, I'd change every single thing I've ever done." This is all sort of a lengthy way of saying that justification, before the inexorable standards of either the arbitrary ones, to say nothing of the law of God, is a driving force in all of our lives, our mental lives, if not our actual professional and emotional and spiritual lives. And lying under all this anxiety is the ultimate anxiety related to our identity. And it's the anxiety of death. David Foster Wallace put it this way: our dread of both relationships and loneliness, both of which are like sub-dreads of our dread of being trapped inside a self, has to do with angst about death, the recognition that I'm going to die and die alone, and the rest of the world is going to go on merrily without me. I strongly suspect that a big part of fiction's job is to aggravate this sense of entrapment and loneliness and death in people, to move people to countenance it, since any possible redemption requires us first to face what's dreadful, what we want to deny. What he's saying is that our anxiety about ourself, being trapped, being contained in a self, feels like death. We're not that far from Isaiah 40, when the prophet writes, "The grass withers and the flowers fall, because the breath of the Lord blows on them. Surely the people are grass." But this is where the Christian message comes into this extremely upbeat conference opener. Aren't you glad you came? The death of one's identity, which happens to all of us and may happen to us over and over again, the death of one's identity may signal something new. The dismantling of the ego may actually spell the beginning of a hope. Because remember, desperation, that's the birthplace of faith. And this is what Pete Townsend was talking about in the third verse of "Who Are You?" The verse that Daltrey belts out like he's in a bar. But if you listen to the words, which no one understands, what you hear is Pete saying the following. He says, "My heart is like a broken cup. I only feel right on my knees. I spit out like a sewer hole, yet still receive your kiss. How can I measure up to anyone now after such a love as this? St. Paul says that for through the law I died to the law so that I might live for God. I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. Meaning when the law of who you should be finally runs its course, that's when you might be open to hearing about something as antiquated and silly and absurd as atonement and the justification of the ungodly. Because remember, talking about anxiety generally doesn't help people. It makes them more anxious. There are limits to self-awareness. The person drowning in a sea of fear doesn't need an explanation. They need salvation. I love Bob Dylan's line. He says, you talk about salvation, people suddenly get tired. They got a million things to do. They're all so inspired. Every time I use the word salvation, I think about that. But the person whose anxiety has brought them to the operating table, maybe they're too anxious to take their medication, or maybe they took too much, isn't interested in a diagnosis, not first and foremost. They're too far gone for a cure, but they might be interested in substitution. They might be interested in a savior, because there are some wounds we'll never get over, some identity markers that will never go away, some thorns so deeply lodged that they can't be excised, some weaknesses which may grow worse. And if the Christian message is to be of any genuine comfort, it must address those situations. It must address the impasse. You know, one of my favorite passages about identity in the Bible is when Jesus in John meets Nathanael. When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said of him, "Here truly is an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael, taken aback, says, "How do you know me?" Jesus answered, "I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you." Then Nathanael declared, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Something about being known in your hiddenness, in your shame-based fear of being ordinary, and being loved, being approached, being embraced, is electric and changes everything. And that is grace. That is one-way love. And it renders the question, who am I, a little less important. This is why Kay Warren, later on, in talking about who we are as Christians, or what it might be to live in a church, she says, "I told Rick, after growing up in that background, when we pass for a church, even if I have to stand on the rooftop of that church, I will tell people that we are just like everybody else. We are sinners. We are broken. There are some days I'm not even sure God exists. Some days I feel like this is a big cosmic joke. We need God to get through every single day." That is a woman who has heard, at least, about the freedom to be a nobody, which is also the freedom to be a somebody. It is the difference between approaching life from salvation rather than for salvation, from approaching life from our acceptance and not for our acceptance, from love and not for love. Of course, this is not something I can talk about or someone can talk to me about, and it can be grasped. We find it impossible to give up our identity markers. As one theologian wrote, our death-infected neurosis is too powerful. We refuse to take up our cross, or as Auden puts it, to climb the cross of the moment and allow our illusions to die. Our ego is in the driver's seat. But this is where Good Friday comes in. Because the reality of Good Friday is that Jesus did become a nobody. He did let go. He was treated as the lowest of the low. No recognition, no affirmation, no thank yous. He was crucified. And he was crucified. He suffered the brunt of our ego management assertion systems of feeling good about ourselves, of the self, of all of our aspirations to be somebody. And there's something here, some gift, some mysterious act of grace by which we are given a new identity, not an improved identity, a new one. Adopted children. Some of you watch Parenthood, Jason Kadam's show. 2 weeks ago was an extremely powerful episode where young Victor, who's been adopted by Joel and Julia Braverman, this couple that is going through a separation, he is given a phone by his father. And the phone causes enormous conflict between the two parents who are trying to work things out. And one day, Victor comes up to his dad. He says, "I don't want this phone anymore. You can take it back. I don't want it." Joel looks at him and says, "What's going on?" "Well, do you think if you take the phone back that Mom will stop being mad at you?" Joel looks at him and says, "Buddy, I messed up, okay? Not you. I should have communicated more with your mom. And that's my fault. We're just trying to figure this situation out, the adults too." The kid says, "But is it my fault that you and Mom got separated?" "Absolutely not," Joel responds. Victor says, "Because Sydney, his sister, said that before I moved in with you guys, everything was better." Joel said, "Okay, first of all, you didn't just move in with us. You understand me? You came to be our son. That means that no matter what happens, no matter what you do, no matter who you become, for the rest of your life, your mom and I are not going to stop loving you. No matter what." He might as well have said, "You, Victor, are enough because of that adoption." Quadrophenia ends with a completely broken down Jimmy, driven to the point of suicide. Alone on a rock in the middle of the Brighton coastline, he's about to throw himself into the water when the skies open up and it begins to rain. And young Jimmy, all of a sudden, is born again. And Townsend makes this very clear. It's not subtle. He says, "I can't sleep and I lay and I think. The night is hot and black as ink. Oh God, I need a drink of cool, cool rain. Love, rain o'er me. Rain o'er me. Love, rain o'er me." This waters of baptism fall on this conflicted, quadrophenic personality who has been driven to death. And that, we find out, is where God is. Amen.